You're listening to iWine Radio.
Thank you very much. This is Bill Mosby, Mosby Winery in Buellton, California.
Welcome to Wine and Dine. My name is Lynn Creelo Chamberlain, host. You're listening to iWine Radio. Joining us this week on iWine Radio is Bill Mosby, who is the owner, winemaker, vineyard manager of Mosby Winery. The website is mosbywines.com, M-O-S-B-Y. They are just north of Santa Barbara in the San Ynez Valley, AVA, and their story is one for the records. And I imagine that Bill Mosby is a stubborn chap because in Land of Pinot Noir, he said, listen, Pinot Noir doesn't like me and my soil, and he specializes in Italian varietals, and he imports some wines as well from Italy. And Mr. Mosby, I too have been to the Alto Adige and fell in love.
It's beautiful up there, isn't it?
Spectacular.
Yeah. When I made that my first trip up there in the Dolomites on both sides and castles, hanging on the cliffs, and Andre Bocelli, I had his tape recording going, and it was just surreal. I just fell in love with it.
The one thing that we can get the wines here, some of the wines, but the one thing I have never been able to get my hands on outside of the region, at least in the United States where I've lived, is Speck.
Yeah, we're mostly local sales. I do have some sales in Los Angeles and a few on the East Coast and in Oregon around the Portland, Willamette Valley area.
So tell us a little bit about your history. And you're a scientist by trade. And so when did you start making wine? When was this fascination with wine born?
Boy, that's a long story. But actually, my first fermentation was when I was 17. And I was a freshman at Oregon State College. It was called College then, it's now Oregon State University. And my grandmother was in Cottage Grove just south of there a little ways, and she had apple trees, and she had an old cider press.
Oh.
And as soon as I got out of the house, away from home, which was really very Spartan, my mother wouldn't even allow wine vinegar in the house. And I think that was kind of a fight against her and her ways of doing things. And I, you know how a 17, you know,
yeah.
Teenagers are.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went down there and made some cider and got it fermenting. And that was I was just totally enthralled with what was going on. And that 5 gallons of cider that's turned into applejack was gone before it was actually through fermentation. I had more visitors in my dormitory room, I'll tell you, from then on. But that was the first time I fermented something, and I have fermented something every year ever since then.
To your recollection, was that apple cider good? Well, I mean, did it actually taste good, or was it, or were the, it was just...
Oh, it was great.
Oh,
it
wow.
It was really good. And, you know, we got it when it was a little sweet. And of course, in those days, I wanted a little sweetness in the wine, and I appreciated that more than the dry. And, of course, that has changed over time.
Yeah.
But there, in the Willamette Valley, and, well, in all of Oregon, there wasn't a wine grape to make wine with. There was the loganberries and blackberries. They had a few wineries around, two or three. And it wasn't until David Lett went up there and got the wine business really started.
And so what year?
That was years later.
Yeah. And so when are we talking about, the 1960s or the 1970s?
When I was at Oregon State, that was 1950s.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, I graduated from Oregon State in 1952.
So you went to you started college as a, really a young man, younger than your peers, weren't you?
Yeah, well, yeah, there was a lot of veterans from World War II, and the camaraderie with these guys was great. You know, they were in their mid 20s, most of them, and I got along with them just famously. And anyway, that's kind of been my forte anyway, getting along with people, I think. That's what happened when I went to Italy for the first trip. I got along with their winemakers so well, and I was just thrilled with what they were doing. And that's a whole other story. It got me into the Italian varietals. But anyway, it was on an airplane trip back from my first trip over there up the Alto Adige that I just had a kind of a revelation on the ride back, about 11-hour trip. And by the time it was over with, I had made my mind up that I was going to change over from what I was doing, which wasn't spectacular because my terroir here at my vineyards was just outside of Santa Rita, which was pioneered by Richard Sanford and Mike Benedict. They picked the right spot for Pinot Noir right off the bat, which was about 50% of the grapes grown in the Santa Ynez Valley have been replaced or grafted over, because at that time no one knew what grape variety would grow best where.
Yeah.
In fact, Firestone was he was helped by they were helped by Andre Chelyshev, and Andre felt that Pinot Noir would grow there. Even a spectacular man like him, he had it wrong. So, but Mike and Richard had it right.
So how did, and you actually gave Pinot Noir what, a 5-year trial run in your vineyard, and it did not, you were not happy with the results.
No, it was. I tried with different clones, and I wasn't happy at all. It wasn't Burgundian. I'm a little picky about Pinot Noir anyway, but if it's not Burgundian, I don't think it's real Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
So. A lot of guys right now, I think, are making Pinot Noir too heavy-handed, too much like a Syrah. That's too dark, too everything.
Yeah.
But that's my opinion. So.
I actually agree with you. I concur entirely.
Yeah.
So.
And so I was about a mile and a half, 2 miles out of the Santa Rita area, and it was enough that my Pinot Noir was just not. It was good juice, but it wasn't good enough. So I gave that up. Along with Chardonnay, I had a lot of Traminer at that time. I saved a little bit of it because my wife loves Traminer. And Chardonnay and Riesling. I had a lot of Riesling to start with because I liked that. But it was a slow sell. So all these things added up on that trip back from Italy. It all gelled, come together, and so I started doing a lot of grafting. It was a big project for me. I learned how to graft a lot, I tell you, all different types of ways. And I had about over 20 acres I had to graft on myself to get them over to the Italian varietals that I wanted.
How did you learn how to do that? Did you talk to a lot of people, and was there somebody mentoring you?
Well, at that time, they had a person who was a professional grafter come out of Yakima Valley, where they grew a lot of apples and stuff.
Yeah.
And he came down, and he had a crew of guys with him. And like I say, most everyone was grafting over at that time to a variety that would probably do better than what they had originally planted. And this person, I would sit there and watch him. It wasn't that much of a deal, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a sharp knife and little bit of an idea how to do it. And so we started grafting over. I'd say we, because it takes a kind of a crew. one to make the scion, and one to put the cleft into the cut into the stalk of the grapevine, and then another one to wrap it, and then another one to come in and cover it over with, at that time it was the black gummy stuff that would dry in about a day, and seal it over. So we would get about 90% take the first time, then we come back the next, about a month or two later, and we'd do some tea budding, and we could get it up to pretty close to, very real close to 100% first year.
Oh my gosh. Did
so it was a learning process to do all this.
And was your intention from the beginning to grow your own grapes? You didn't want to buy grapes from somebody. You wanted to be landowner, vineyard.
Yeah. You got it exactly right.
Yeah.
I think that to be called a real winemaker, you got to be in that vineyard all the time, because the old saw of wine is made in a vineyard. That's absolute truth.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had complete control, and I have learned a lot about changing terroir actually in a vineyard by leaf pulling, by shoot selection, and by dropping fruit, by trimming and whatever, getting rid of all the foliage that might be shading the fruit in the wrong spot. And all these things add up to the terroir in the vineyard, I call it.
How old are your oldest vines at present?
You know, I have vines I planted in 1971 that was grafted over to Pinot Grigio, and they're on their own rootstock, Riesling rootstock, and they are still healthy.
Oh, wow.
And it's amazing. It's in a sandy loam soil. That's on the other side of the river from the winery. And and I had grown carrots there before, and that would be you'd think ideal spot for a nematode because of the carrots being there and all. But I have had no problem whatsoever with this Riesling. I had some Pinot Noir also over there on its own rootstock, and that is a real weak rootstock. I've had to replace those.
Let's talk about the wines that you make and the grapes that you grow. And unless you want to change this up, I was going to do it in alphabetical order, and starting with Cortese.
Cortese, I got those, most of these cuttings I got from right here in California. Hmm. Cortese I got from Peter Poole. He was at Mount Palomar in Temecula. I don't know if he owns that winery yet. He sold me the cuttings, and he charged me outlandish price for them because he's the only one that had Cortese at that time. And the thing that come around, though, was really funny is, they had the Pearson's disease down there, and wiped him out. And he gave me a call a few years later and wanted to buy some Cortese cuttings. And I told him, you know what you did to me? Well, you're going to get the same treatment back. And so I charged him the same price that he charged me for. Anyway, the Cortese, I like it as a still wine. I like it probably more as a sparkling wine. And about every other year, I do make a sparkling wine. Weibel, I'll make the cuvée, then I run it up to Weibel, and they'll sparkle it for me. It's a Charmat process.
So is that what's on the website as Stellini di Cortese?
Stellini di Cortese, that's the sparkling wine.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as I recall, last time I looked, your still Cortese was sold out, but you have some sparkling?
I have sparkling, yes.
Okay. And very reasonably priced, $20 a bottle.
Yeah, well, Charmat, it's easier than the imports.
Yes.
I import is all done in a bottle, and it's a little different.
And if people join your wine club, they get a discount on shipments, on wines, right?
That's true. I don't know exactly what it is. That's not my
yes,
end
of
the deal. But they are given a discount, right? Yeah.
Dolcetto.
I picked those up over in Italy. I was staying at Giano di Alba, which is a little bed and breakfast there. It's right in the middle of the Dolcetto area. And in fact, they have an AVA in Giano di Alba. And so it was wintertime, it was in February, I think, and snow all over the ground. And I took a chance on one evening of just going out in the vineyard and getting some cuttings. And I knew that they would be Dolcetto, which they were. So that's where my Dolcetto cuttings came from.
And what did you do, put them in your suitcase to come back home with you?
You know, in those times, you could get on an airplane that they...
Yeah.
They would believe everything you said anyway.
Yeah.
And anyway, I had an old, rusty, dusty sport coat. I still have it. And the lining was wore out on it. And I would make these cuttings long enough from my wrist to my elbow. And I'd shove them up a hole that was in my lining of my coat.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, you only need about half a dozen, actually, to get started, because half a dozen has maybe, well, 4 or 5 buds on it, and you get, so right there, you got 25 plants, and from 25 plants, the next year, away you go. You know, you have a vineyard, so.
What did your wife say about that?
She wasn't usually on those trips with me. I think she only went over to Italy with me once. She does her thing, and I was doing mine.
Oh, my gosh. Now, I just had your Lagrine a couple nights ago, and it's spectacular.
Okay, the Lagrine, I do get buy that grape. I buy that grape from French Camp, which is owned by Bian Nacido, the boys.
Oh.
And it's grown up there about halfway between Santa Margarita and Bakersfield.
Okay.
And it's a nice warm area, and they do a great job for me.
Now, you already mentioned Pinot Grigio.
Right. That Pinot Grigio actually came from David Lett.
Oh, wow.
He brought him up into Oregon, and my contact was not with David Lett, but was Harry Peterson. Do you know them?
Yes, yes.
Harry Peterson and his wife, I think, is Nedry.
Yes.
Harry Peterson. Yeah, Harry Peterson sent me some cuttings from David Lett's vineyard.
Wow.
That was way back, man. That was, I forget when it was.
Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, we were the first ones to bottle Pinot Grigio in Santa Barbara County.
Sangrantino,
another story, man. I ran into this fellow, Guido Sodano, at Vin Italy, and he was in charge of a couple large vineyards, rice fields in the Piemonte. He had his hands full with all this. And anyway, I was introduced by a couple doctors, Agostino Tarditi. What was his name? I'll think of it in a little bit. Anyway, I asked him about Sangrantino, and I tried to get some cuttings from him, and he would not bring them. I went 3 years in a row to Italy to get these cuttings, and he says, I can't give them to you, Bill, because they aren't virus-free yet.
Oh, yeah.
And then 1 year, I went in there and met him at Vin Italy, and he's behind the booth. He had a big smile on his face, and he had a box of cuttings. Not only cuttings, but they were already grafted to a Richter 110. And so there was 50 of them in this box.
Wow.
And now that was not like you could put up your sleeve, you know.
Right.
It was
right.
A whole different deal. So there was four of us. One guy that was on that trip, one of them I didn't trust. The other two I did. And so I took a handful, and the other guy who had a cherry orchard, he took a handful, and the bulk of them we left right in the box, and we all went to different customs lines coming back in. the guy that had the bulk of them, he had them right in front of him on top of his suitcase, and he walked right up to the customs. And right then, down the line of ways, a kid got sick and was starting to vomit. And he says, get out of here. Keep going. Just keep going. And so we brought every one of those cuttings in. So that's where I got my Sagrantino.
That was meant to be.
Five or three, ready to go.
Meant to be.
I think so, yeah.
Sangiovese.
Sangiovese. If we're really going through the history on these, Sangiovese actually came from Castella Rompola by way of Montevina, by way of Caprarola and Paso Robles, by way of Carrari and Los Alamos, and then I got them. This is all put together by Daryl Corti, by the way.
Oh,
and I'm sure you know Daryl Corti.
Yes, yes.
And he put this thing together with Castella Rompola and Montevina. And from then, they passed on, you know, cuttings. And so that's basically where most of my Sangiovese came from. I have some different clones since then, but that's where the bulk of them are.
Okay, how about Teroldego?
Teroldego.
Teroldego.
Teroldego. I was at Geierhoff Winery up in Alto Adige, and I was with a guy who was importing wines from Geierhoff, and so he was treating us real well, and we tasted a lot of white wines, which I expected were very good. And then he wanted to take us to dinner, and so we went over to dinner in a bowling alley. He thought that all Americans would want a bowl. Anyway, none of us wanted the bowl. We just sat down for dinner, and he pulled out a red wine. And in my mind, I was thinking, you know, all these whites, and then this red, it probably is not going to be any good. And it was spectacular. We went through, I don't think it was about five of us, we went through with six bottles of it.
Whoa.
And I went to Luigi, the winemaker, and I says, I got to have these cuttings, which he promised to send, which he didn't send. But that spring, I was going to a farmer's market here in Buellton, and I ran into Jim Clendenin. And I said, hey, Jim, I ran into this best red grape. I think it would be a great one for anyone who has a Pinot Noir that was pale in color and lacked a lot of a flavor and whatever. And Jim's wife at that time says, well, he says, what a grape is it? And I says, Teroldego. And his wife spoke up and says, well, we've got five of those vines in our backyard right now.
Whoa.
And immediately I asked her if I could have the cuttings. And Billy Watham from Foxen was doing the pruning for them in the backyard. And I asked Billy if he could get me some of those cuttings. And he brought over 80 cuttings. And that from those five vines, and that's where I got my turtle to go started.
Oh my gosh!
It's all these different varieties. I've got a story behind them.
Yeah,
I tell you.
Well, that's what's so marvelous is the stories. And now you have to talk to us about Nebbiolo.
Nebbiolo, yeah. That's I really want to make a nice Nebbiolo, and I've got the cuttings to do it. They came from Rosciato Nursery. It's the largest grapevine nursery in the world, and it's up in the Friuli area. And anyway, I talked to a good friend, winemaker in La Marche, and he says, well, I can get you some. Well, he tried to buy them, and they said, no, you're from La Marche. We can't sell you anything. And because it wasn't allowed to be grown in that area. Anyway, this fellow had a good winemaker friend up in Piemonte, and they sold them to him, and then was sold from him down to my friend in La Marche, and then he shipped them over to me. And just UPS.
Oh, wow.
And so that got my Nebbiolo started. And I'm working with that grape yet. It's in virgin soil. I didn't know I'd have that much problem with it, with the voles and the gophers and the deer and
okay.
whatever. It was. It's really tough to start out a new vineyard, as far as I was concerned. Anyway, a highlight in that is 2013, I did get a good vintage off of there, and I think it's going to be great. So I hope I hang in there long enough to get a bottle of some real nice Nebbiolo.
You already mentioned Treminer. And for some people might not know Gewurztraminer, and Treminer is very popular in Alto Adige, and
right.
And you ferment it dry or barely off dry,
right? And those grapes, the vines came from Mirasu. You don't hear much about Mirasu anymore.
Yeah, you don't.
I think Gallo bought them out, and I don't know that they use their name much anymore.
I never see it anymore.
No, but back then Mirasu was a pretty big name.
Yes.
And and they had Treminer, and I got those clone that they had. But Rosciato, that big nursery in Italy, up in Friuli, in Italy, they have a section where they make wine out of all the varieties they have and all the clones they have. And with the right credentials, you can come in there, sit down, and you're treated royally, and they give you a menu, and they have a list of all these wines, and if they say, which one are you interested in? And you could pick a multitude of different ones, and they come over, and from different clones like Treminer, they had three different clones of Treminer
wow.
the last time I was over there, and one of them I selected, and so I UPS'd some of those over to help the aromatics in the Treminer that I have of Mirasu.
Where you go to taste of in Italy, is this in Verona?
It's in Verona, right.
Okay, okay.
Right.
So I understand. I'm sorry, go on.
No, it's a real big deal over there. And the problem is the parking. It's thousands of people coming in there. The parking and the bathrooms.
I noticed that you are going to be releasing an olive oil here shortly. So talk to us about your olive oil.
Figaro Mountain Olive Oil Company do the processing, and I pick them where they're just a blush of darkness comes on the olives, and it's extra virgin that they come off with, no heat involved, and no chemicals, of course, and it's a really a green, dark green, and a spiciness to it that's great.
I can just imagine what it smells like through the phone lines. I know what fresh squeezed olive oil smells like. It's delicious. Your artwork is so unique and so eye-catching. Share with listeners the story of how you came about with your really distinctive branding with respect to your artwork and your labels.
Yeah, I was with my wife and one other person, Peter Young. He's in the wine industry also, in different phases of it. He's had a distributorship. He's imported. He's worked as a salesman, as a CEO of Crisa Wine Incorporated in San Francisco. Anyway, we were all, the three of us were staying over there, and he selected the place where we were going to stay, and it was a Freudenstein castle. And this was, again, January, February, and it was cold. There was no tourists around. And we came in that evening, the first day, and the lady in charge, Giselle was her name, and she said that we wasn't going to go to the dining room because there was just us and one other guest, if we didn't mind having him with us. And, of course, we were after wine, you know, you get
right.
to love everyone. And so there was no problem there. And this fellow came in, and he spoke German only. And before the evening was over and nine bottles of wine, Giselle helped us, by the way, with those. And they had a great cellar in this castle, too. And it turned out this guy was, that we had such a good time with him. There was no way I could express the fun we had because he would draw pictures on the napkins, and he wanted us to draw, and he was trying to get us get a feeling for us, Americans. And when it was all over with and decided to go to bed, I just reached over and kissed him right on the forehead. And he jumped out of his chair, grabbed me, and swung me around and tried to do a waltz with me. And anyway, met him the next day and set up a deal to go look at his gallery and his artwork. And right there was born the fact that he said, I've never done the art label for a wine bottle, but wow. I'll do one for you.
Wow.
And the first one was the Pinot Grigio. And he had it all figured out in his mind. Pinot Grigio doesn't know if it's a red or a white. You know, it's an ugly-looking grape. It doesn't. On a vine, sometimes birds will leave it for another variety that's right next to it because it's not attractive on the vine.
Hmm.
But anyway, it doesn't know if it's red or white. And he had depicted two ladies on the label. One was a dark-complexioned lady, and one was a fair lady. And he put it right there exactly. He had it all figured out.
The labels are collectible. They're so beautiful.
Yeah, he was in that area. He is so well known that most government buildings have some mosaic or some painting of his on it. And I've been walking down the street with him in Bolzano and had people stop their car in the middle of the street, run over and shake his hand. Just quite a guy.
Do you have the original artwork that all the labels are based on?
I'm missing one, and I don't know where it went. That happened to be the original Pinot Grigio label. I don't know what happened to it.
So, and every wine has a different label.
Right. In fact, I was at Vin Italy with him one time, and there was a lineup of different varieties of bottles, and they all was the same look. And it amazed him that the label didn't depict what was in the bottle whatsoever, and that's what he's trying to do. And so I send, when I want a label, I'll send the wine over to him, and then he'll go from there and make a label for it.
Last question I have for you, which I think is unique, at least in the United States, and that is that you have a tiny chapel on your estate.
Yes. it's a lovely spot up there on top of above the Nebbiolo Vineyard, and it overlooks the San Andres Valley, overlooks Highway 101 to the south. If I was a little higher, I could actually see the Pacific Ocean from there. We're only 8 miles from the Pacific Ocean to the south, and we're about 25 probably close to that to the west, or from the east from the Pacific Ocean. So the chapel, yeah, it's a nice place. I pointed it well with some antique pews and some chairs and a table, and of course a Bible.
Has anyone ever requested the favor of being married in your chapel?
There has been interest in it, and but the problem I have is getting up there and making it. I'd have to talk to my insurance guy.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yes, yeah. So this is really private. It's for family for the most part.
Well, so far it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
If it was worked out to where the insurance would be all right, I'd have to have them look at it. Because it's kind of a windy road to get up there, and I don't know. Maybe if I had the driver was licensed for that, possibly that'd be all right.
Oh, wow. Bill Mosby, this has been such a pleasure meeting you, and we thank you so very much for sharing all these terrifically personal stories. This is, to me, what makes wine more interesting than anything is the stories, how everything came about. For people to learn more and order the wines online, including joining the wine club, you will want to go to mosbywines.com. That's mosbywines.com. And we thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you very much. This is Bill Mosby, Mosby Winery in Buellton, California.
You're listening to iWine Radio. I'm Lynn Crelo-Chamberlain.